Hello and welcome to Walking with Purpose, a podcast where we engage in real, in-depth conversations regarding social issues, current events, marriage, relationships, and anything that moves us. We speak our truth. We stand in the truth as we share our real life experiences, one podcast at a time. I'm Chris. I'm joined today by my co-host,
Santana.
Jeff.
Today's topics, we're going to talk about Negroland. We're going to touch on Martin Luther King Jr. and his history and his legacy. And we're going to talk about a little bit about Jesse Jackson and some interesting facts about Jesse Jackson and his actions on the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Negroland. We're going to talk about Negroland. The U.S. today is homeland to many of Negroes who were descendants of the tribe of Judah, as well as other tribes of Israel. During the transatlantic slave trade, millions of black people were taken from an area in Africa called Negroland. These black people were taken and sold into slavery, and they were called Negroes. Oh yeah, I forgot to introduce our special guest again, Willie Gibson. Let's give him a hand, y'all. He back.
You know, just like in anything in education, it's important to kind of, you know, understand historically things, how they come about and how they're kind of brought into focus. You know, that term Negroes is a term historically used for people of Black African heritage. Comes from Spanish and in Portuguese, where the English took the word from and applied it to Negroes in Africa, and as a classification of and then it being used as an offensive word towards slaves.
Right, but there was a place specifically called Negro Land, and who were those Negroes? Were those Negroes?
Well, what was interesting when they say the slaves was taken from Negro land, it's interesting to know about something I kind of researched, the slave papers. Whenever you've seen slave papers, they used to say Negroes for sale. So that lets you know they were taken from an area. The map of 1747 actually has Negro land on it. And so what ends up happening is you know that those people that's on those slave papers came from that area called Negroland. Very close to the slave coast, the grain coast, and the gold coast. It was a land where people from Israel had ran into Africa fleeing a war with Rome. And when they ran into Africa, they ran into one particular area. Some fled north, but the ones that didn't created their own community. And they fled in Africa because they looked like the people of Africa, not just like an African, but the same skin tone, same skin colors. But they had their own, rituals and their own ways that was different than the Africans. So just like anything, if you're different than somebody else, a lot of times people, you know, they might not like you. They might think you're different, anything like that. But they look like them. That's why they ran in there. Rome could not run into Africa. And Rome couldn't come into Africa because it was, at that particular time, Holland, England, and Denmark controlled Africa. So they had to stop before they went into Africa. So that's where the Negroes came from. And that's where the term Negro land actually started.
And that was West Africa, I think.
Yes.
Where a lot of the slaves were brought into America from West Africa. Yeah. What countries were in Negro land? Was there any countries in Negro land? Or was it just one big area? From the research you guys have done, I mean, I think.
I've just seen the word Guinea. I don't know if they say it like that or Guinea as G-U-I-N-E-A. I've seen a map, and the map that I seen was by the guy that actually made or created the map. It was in 1693. They called it Upper New Guinea, and there were a lot of European settlements in there. So that's why they were able to have a lot of those transports in and out for different goods and text. I mean, they were trading slaves for textiles. They was trading slaves for alcohol, tobacco, all these different things were coming out of that Western culture. There's even, they don't talk about this as much, but there was, I think his name was Ferdinand. He was one of the first sailors that came along that West Coast that brought Africans into Rome. And the Pope had about 7 to 8 African slaves from this guy. And so because of their settlements along that coast, he gave this guy, the name of that coast is named after that particular guy that sailed there. And he had the opportunity to bring so many slaves all over the place, but they named this after him. I think his name was Ferdinand. I remember reading about it. But yeah, I mean, that West Coast of Africa, you're talking 2 to 3 million slaves. But a lot of people don't also know that 90% of the slaves that left that area did not come to America. Only about 2% of those slaves came to America. The other 90% were in the Caribbean, South America, all those different areas that they derived from. That's where they came, because all those settlements were European settlements. So England, Spain, Portuguese, all of them owned those settlements. So all that we know of today, Costa Rica, all of them were all settlements from Europeans.
And it was a slave trade. They used them as slave labor to build those countries, I'm sure.
Yes.
They brought them in.
What's interesting about that is now you can actually see how the slaves actually built up all of these different countries of free labor. And that's how they became so rich, as all this free labor going on. And same way here in America, free labor, and you have the cotton and everything that was going on then, that built the United States.
You ever seen cotton? You ever seen cotton?
I've seen it.
You ever picked it?
Never.
It's very pretty.
It's thorns, man.
Yeah.
A lot of thorns in it.
And that's some hard labor, brother.
And they actually had to fill bags.
Yes.
They had quotas.
And if you've ever seen one, as my grandmother used to tell me, and I've seen it, but I never actually did what she did. If you pull on it, it snaps. So it snaps back with those thorns.
Yes.
So you can imagine if you don't have, you just starting out and you're trying to learn how to pick it, you're going to be catching a lot of marks on you.
No. What U.S. territory did the first slaves land in America?
If I'm not mistaken,
I think it was Virginia,
Jamestown, Virginia.
Yeah.
And as you know, as Santana was talking earlier about ancestry, my ancestry says part of my heritage came from Virginia.
Wow.
So a lot of the plantations of Virginia, where it was, went from Jamestown and then it spread throughout Virginia. So a lot of my heritage comes from Virginia.
I haven't did that 23andMe thing yet. I'm interested in doing it. I know a little bit about my history. We got a lot of roots from Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, Shreveport. So I'm interested in doing some of my genealogy here soon. Anything you guys else want to add about Negro land? I know there's a map. I know there are certain countries. Obviously we know that these Negroes that they called Negroes were from West Africa, because that's where the slave trade began.
You know, it's kind of interesting when I was kind of looking at a lot of the research of it in Africa, because you think about how many slaves they say were transported in just West Africa.
Right.
We're not even talking about the rest of Africa. We just that West. And if you think about it, there's over 2 billion, maybe 3 billion people in Africa today. That's a lot of people. I mean, when you think about it.
Well, I'll tell you something that was interesting that I saw, and you can look it up on YouTube, when all the, it was a lot of different kings of Africa got together, and they apologized for selling the Hebrew Israelites, which we call Negroes, into slavery. And so I think on the anniversary of the 400 years, they, in certain places in Africa now, African-Americans can go and purchase land, where before they couldn't go purchase land. And so now they can actually own land, and they actually want many of the people here to go back and purchase land and build up the country.
Wow. I know all the Africans I've ran into in my days, they looked at us different, man, because of our mixed blood. They don't look at us as true Africans or true descendants from Africa.
Well, I'll say it like this. I had a friend from Nigeria that was here, and it was interesting talking to him, because when I first started coming into this knowledge, I was talking to him and I asked him a question. I said, do you know who we are here? And he told me he knew who we were. And I said, wow, that's interesting. So many of the people even here are related to Nigerians and Ghana.
Yeah.
A lot of them from Ghana also.
Right.
They're related to a lot of the people that's in the Nigerian and Ghana area.
What about Sudan?
I don't believe many of them here, because if you even look at a Sudanese person, their features are very different.
Right. Than Africans. Huh?
Right. Just like Somali, all of them. You can tell when you look at a Somalian, you can look at a Somalian anywhere you know that Somalian, because their features is totally different. So when you see many people from the Ghana area and you see many people from Nigeria, they look just like us. So, our facial features look a lot alike.
All right, let's jump into MLK, man. That was interesting. I did a little research about MLK. I know he talked about that he predicted his death. He talked about that in some speeches. The biggest thing that I've researched, one of the things that I researched is they knew who Martin Luther King was, and they knew he was coming to Memphis, right? To speak on what the sanitation was.
Yeah, the sanitation. There was like 1,300 people that were striking because of the unfair wages and the kind of just the treatment that they were receiving. And he was coming to speak and help in the just the walk. He was coming to give kind of like it some credence, to give it some speed. Because prior to that, he was at another meeting, which a lot of people think today that had a lot to do with him being assassinated. He was at another meeting, which had all kinds of people at the table. I think we talked about it before, where he had Jews and Mexicans. And he also grouped with Cesar Chavez about, the workers. And he was trying to talk about equal opportunity, equal pay. And then he came to Memphis to kind of give, credence to this big, strike that was about to occur. So it was what brought him there.
What I found interesting about it is they had, like you said, 1,300 workers. But here's what was interesting to me that I researched, that all of them were Black. All of the 1,300. And the real reason he was here was because two of them had got crushed in an accident. So when they got crushed, their safety conditions was a big problem with the outcome of why he actually came. The working conditions, just like you were saying, the working conditions was a big thing. And so when two got crushed I don't know how they got crushed, but and then they were all Black, they were letting you know right there they really didn't give a care about their safety conditions.
I guess they really didn't give a care about his safety as well, as popular as he was. From what I read, the police presence at the Lorraine Motel the evening he was shot was null and void, that they had left. And then I read something about where Martin Luther King wasn't really supposed to be on the balcony, that someone had changed his room. He was supposed to be in the garden. Putting him in the balcony in that room, he placed him in direct, line sight of the shooter. And then I'm hearing that there wasn't only one shooter, that there was two shooters, and those guys were marksmen, depending because of where he was, you know, where he was shot, how he was shot, and from the distance that he was shot at. So that's interesting. What was his last speech there? What did he talk about?
I remember it being the one about I might not get to the mountaintop with you. That was the night before it, and he was actually sick that night. Mm. But and they were they were trying to get him to rest. I think if I remember, Ralph Abernathy was trying to get him to rest, but he felt the need to be there that night to speak. And so I know when I listen to that speech, it sounds like when you hear him, it sounds like he knew it wasn't going to be too long before he wasn't going to be here. When you listen to the speech and you just see it, you know, we get to not only see him speak, but we see his face. It just seemed like he knew something was not going to go well. And sometimes, we don't know, but when I look back at it, that was like a real important speech because he was really trying to emphasize that even in death, there's sacrifices.
You know, it's funny. It's a lot of different things I think about. But, when you have unions, and back in the day, that's what Cesar Chavez, all of them were unions. Guys would get killed quick just trying to unionize people because they knew they would give them power and it would take the power from the company and would give it to the people. So there's so many different aspects to this that I don't think anybody would really know why he was gone, but or who actually did it. But to his deathbed, the shooter said he never shot him.
Right.
Yeah. I heard that exact same thing, too. I read that same thing.
And, when a guy's on his deathbed, that's when he tells the truth.
That's right. That's when the truth comes
that's
out.
That's when the truth comes out.
Yeah. J. Edgar Hoover. He was a cold piece, man.
Racist.
Yes. He tried to publicly and privately destroy the reputation and the influence of MLK through wiretaps. And I'm pretty sure there was some type of informants in MLK's camp.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. And one of the names that keeps popping up is Jesse. Jesse Jackson, as an informant.
Reverend.
Yeah, as an FBI informant. And they're saying that that Jesse was the one that initiated the room change from the garden to the balcony. So Jesse's a cold piece, man, from everything that I've read. I mean, he wanted to be the next one in line. He wanted to be the next leader.
And our history tends to show itself. There's always someone wanting to take someone's place. And it's been done all through history. If you go back, we go back to Esau, somebody wanted to take the birthright of Esau. So he tricked his dad, who was going blind and, thinking that it was actually Esau, and giving him the birthright. So he took it. We can go back to Cain and Abel, right? Uh-huh. Who thought that God was showing his brother too much favor, so he decided to kill his brother. You know what I mean? So that mentality of wanting something that someone has or wanting to be next in line has shown itself all throughout history.
Right.
So as you were saying, I'm not surprised.
Hosea Williams. If you ever get a chance to listen to his speech, it's on YouTube as well. Jesse claimed that he was next to Martin Luther King Jr. He held his head in his hand while he was dying. And Hosea Williams, the only two people that were there were Ralph Abernathy and Hosea Williams. Jesse was nowhere near that MLK when he died. But he claimed that he did. And Hosea Williams claims that Jesse raked some of MLK's blood off the floor and put it on his shirt.
Yeah, that's it. I'll say this. That's very interesting. I don't put nothing past nobody, because if you got to set something up, you're going to set it up. Mm-hmm. You have to make it look good.
Yep.
But unfortunately, we weren't there. Mm-hmm. So,
but Hosea Williams was.
Well, yeah.
Hosea Williams said he was next to MLK when he was shot. He said Jesse did not hold his head in his hands. He said Jesse raked Dr. King's blood from the floor and put it on his shirt, and that they called a staff meeting after the shooting, and Jesse claimed to be ill. So Ralph Abernathy told Jesse to go to his room and relax. And the next thing they know, the next morning, they see Jesse in Chicago on TV with a bloody shirt telling those lies that, you know, that he was next to Dr. Luther King, that he held his head while he was dying and all that other stuff. Jesse got on a plane the same day that MLK was killed and went to Chicago, and the next morning he was on the news. Jesse had ambitions.
Well, I'd say this like this. You ever notice, Jesse never really came under fire. Mm-mm. And when I say fire, I don't mean shooting. I mean just public firing. He only came under firing with us.
Right.
So that right there tell you something.
If you get a chance to listen to that tape of the YouTube of Hosea Williams, he talks about it, man. Jesse was a cold piece, man.
I mean, if you look back, if we think in our lifetime right now, what has Jesse Jackson really done?
Push.
Yeah.
And I never knew what that Rainbow Coalition really was about. Mm-mm. Because it seemed like it's faded away. And it seems like, if you think about it, it seems like Jesse has faded away too. And unfortunately, we don't know. We weren't there. But, you know, sometimes in life you see men's lives kind of dwindle away when there might have been some things they've done that have not been for the benefit of people.
Right.
Well, it was, I'll say it like this. It was interesting to see they have a tape out there when Barack Obama was elected president, and Jesse Jackson had some disparaging remarks.
Right, he did. That's what I heard.
But then he showed up to the inauguration mm-hmm. with full water in his mm-hmm. eyes. And I don't know how you can go from one extreme to the next.
Jesse was a cold piece, man. There's been rumors that Dr. King was alive when he arrived at the hospital. He was taken to St. Joe's Hospital. And they said that one of the nurses said that the doctor, is a neurosurgeon called Dr. Breen Bland, suffocated MLK with a pillow.
Yeah, and I heard they spit on him also.
Mm.
Yes. But if you know now, a few years back, Coretta Scott King, she got a settlement.
Mm.
She got a settlement, undisclosed settlement about that.
About that, it's?
Yes.
Yeah, because according to the nurse, the surgical nurse, her name was Lula Mae Shelby, that Dr. Bland suffocated King with a pillow, that he was alive when he got to the hospital. And then on the flip side of that, there's Abernathy said that he was there with King in the emergency room, and, you know, he was close to King, and he sat there and watched King's breath slowly, descend, you know, breath by breath by breath by breath. He said that he died at the hospital, that he witnessed him dying. So it's just a lot of a lot of rumors, a lot of things, a lot of about the history and his death that we really don't know. Well, then there's probably, two sides of the story.
We'll probably never know.
Never too. Know.
And then also, I also heard that the kids were in on that suit too.
Yes.
I heard that the whole family was in on that suit. They all got paid.
So they all got paid. So yeah, there has to have been some type
so something
of
was to
some
it.
Validity to
some
it.
Some government, something was to it. But it's undisclosed, and they couldn't, I don't think they could talk about it. They could actually talk about it.
Yeah, that's great.
Because the research doesn't say, you know, the amount. It doesn't say.
Right.
It just says there was a settlement reached that included all the members of the family.
Who are our leaders? From the African-American standpoint now, today, who are our leaders? Do we have any leaders? Where are we going? Or do we have a direction?
I honestly don't think the leader can be one person. I think the leader has to be a collective group of people, because we've already seen what happens when you have one person step out and what we presume to be leaders that we can talk about in our lifetime. We think of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, people that try to tell you about, you know, self-preservation and how to take care of yourself and how to move forward. But I think it's a collective. It's going to start in every.
But who are those people? And do we really need a leader? Do we really need a leader in the to fight for the black community or in the black community? All I see are lawyers coming in after the fact.
That's true.
That's all I see is lawyers.
And that's actually what I was going to mention, being Crump. That's yeah, funny you said that.
I see
that.
Crump all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is he a leader?
Yeah. Yeah. I think some of the leaders now are people that are in high position that go against the system. Mm. And so when you hear somebody like Kanye, do I consider him a revolutionary leader? No. But because of where he's at now, mm-hmm. him going against a system, losing the money that he lost, and then to come back now, and Adidas is trying to get him back again now because they're going under. I consider him somewhat someone that you can look at and as a person of interest.
Okay. All right. Because
not necessarily. Because
they showed him who he really was when they took away all those sponsorships.
Right. Well, but that's
control.
But that's
controlling a Negro. Right.
But that lets you know he was in some type of position.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't do all that without him being in position. And the thing is,
but the fact that they took it away from him.
That's because we're not in the room. He's in the room. He's in conversations we'll never get access to.
But he's in the room by himself. And that's one of our issues. That's what I see. When I look at education, corporation, I think of all that. Who's in the room to make the decisions for those that are in the room? You know what I mean? Because think about this. We know right now that over 50% of the American population is Hispanic. It could be that all at once. But if they're not in the room, it ain't going to matter if they're the most populated people in the United States. Because in order to have any movement of anything, you have to be a part of the process. You have to be in the room. And like you said, he was in the room, but he was the only one in the room. You know what I mean? So if we sporadically have all these different things, like we got some people we know, Jay-Z, that had part ownership of the Nets. And we had all these, but you're the only person in the room.
But is that good for us as a whole, as a community? You being the only one in the room.
I'll say it like this. Jay-Z never exposed the room. Kanye exposed the room.
Mm.
Jay-Z still got all his money.
Mm.
A lot of money. Kanye's money. He was a billionaire. Kanye's money got taken. So, he was in the room and he was exposing the room, and that's what the problem is. And because if he started saying who we are, like Kyrie did and like Nick Cannon was doing, and you saw they weren't even in the room Kanye was in, and you see what happened to them.
Why is white America afraid of the truth?
No, they're not afraid of the truth. They're afraid of the Negro because they know who the Negro is. They know who the Negro is.
Mm.
They know the history we don't know. They know the history we don't know, and they're trying to hide it. And if they keep it hid and keep us blind and keep us being a consumer, what do we do? What do we do? We just going to look for our things that gets us through the day. We're not looking for how our kids is going to come up later on.
Right. And if we don't make money, they don't make money.
They make money off of certain things, but they don't make money off the majority.
No, if Kanye sells a million records, I mean, they'll give him his cut. But they're making money. Just like in all sports, too. Same thing. They're making money.
people tend to forget that when you're talking about sports, as you just brought up, in the NBA,
NFL,
they are billionaires. We're not talking millionaires. They're billionaires. And if you combine all of them together in esport, they're well over $1 trillion. So when you put a product, it's easy for the public to sit and have these conversations about how much an athlete makes and, oh, that's a lot of money. How does he act like this? What do he do? Well, what you don't know behind closed doors is sometimes the owners are acting worse than the athletes. But because they have the money, we look at them like they're so professional. They're so, you know, in the room. And I've talked to people that have been in different scenarios, and they were really surprised at the way billionaires and millionaires act.
And even as an athlete making a lot of money, shouldn't you carry yourself a certain way?
But here's the problem with that. Where they come
from. Your conduct.
Where they come from. Mm. We gotta always look at that. Where do they come from? I mean, we sit up here as men that have, and women that have a profession. We have, when we go to that profession, we're supposed to conduct ourselves a certain way. But we also talk about our traumas and the different things we've been through. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the people that we've probably met, the people that have probably poured into us, that helped shape and form us to be a little bit different in how we carry out our professionalism. But when you're going from people that are, you know, holding you in this esteem as a young athlete, but they don't teach you all the other little things that's going to come up about your professionalism and all this, then it gets haywire when you get a bunch of money. I mean, think of the money and the fame and the commercials and all these different things coming at kids that are 16, 17, 18, which is what NIL is doing right now.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you have parents that don't know nothing about that. And now you got a parent and a child that don't know about it. And then you get to have someone that creeps in that tells you how it's supposed to go. And you don't even know the type of morality or character that that person has. You just agreeing with them because they say they know how to deal with their with your money.
Right.
And it's very difficult. And so we have a difficult time because, again, there's not enough of us in the room.
Well, you know, I look at it like this. Money gives you access, and all access to everything is not always a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so money can give you access into an open door. Well, that open door behind it might have every counter with alcohol in it, drugs, everything might be on that counter inside. Well, before, because they didn't have access, they couldn't get into that door. That access is a lot of times the devil. Mm. In the word, it says, come out from amongst them. That means that there's certain doors you wasn't supposed to go into. And so as athletes, they get that money and it gives them access. And so if they wasn't raised up with a certain type of belief system or certain morals, that money is going to do nothing but corrupt them.
How y'all feel about reparations?
That again goes back to what he just said. You can get all the reparations you want, but what kind of, what are you going to do with it? What system is set up in your family to deal with that type of money? If you get it, are you going to save it? Are you going to spend it? What are you going to do? Are you going to go out there and just blow it? What system do you have? And so you can give people all the money you want, but if you don't have a system set up in place of how to deal with it correctly, then what does it do? Case in point, let's look at the casinos and the Indians, right? Mm-hmm. They got a board. They were at one point in time, even though their kids were getting all this money, their board stepped in to make sure that they didn't, because they were blowing it at one point in time on cars, alcohol. You stayed within your reservation, but you were blowing that money. So then their board decided we have to go in a different direction. Pop casinos. And if you notice, you don't see as much widespread corruption that we see because they have now formed a governing body on how they deal with that money. And you don't see it as much. And now they got it within their reservation and their law because they have their own laws within the reservation.
Right.
And
right.
So now
still federal land.
Yeah. So we, or it's reservation like, land. Yeah, reservation. But we don't have that set up. I hear Like people sometimes, I listen to Magic Johnson, I listen to different guys, Shaq. They talk about how, why you see Shaq everywhere? Because he is talking about leaving a legacy for his family. But he said, I'm not giving them nothing. They're going to have to work on it, even though you know he's leaving this. Mm-hmm. But they try to tell, I hear them saying, they try to tell athletes how to go about the business. And like we were talking earlier, some guys don't know what that's like. You can hear it, but if you don't act on it, it ain't going to matter.
So you think them giving us reparations is just going, we're just going to go buck wild with it?
Well, I got an interesting concept on this, and I promise you, pretty much this is going to happen. Because most, put it this way, most of us haven't been trained in money. So they're going to give us the money, but it's going to go right back to them. Mm. So it's not like
they're going to create avenues.
They're going to create avenues for them. So now you're going to see more stores opening up. You're going to see more Nikes getting here, more this, more that, more sports teams, more everything. And they're going to be going buck wild with that money because many of them wasn't trained with it.
What if they piecemeal it to us? Give it us like a monthly allowance?
I don't think it should be a monthly allowance, to be real with you. Because if
it's they talked about that,
if it's a monthly, I said like this:
give me $900 a month.
Yeah, so you can die in the money. Stay where?
Right.
It ain't going to go to your family. Mm-hmm. It ain't going to come down because they're going to give it to everybody at one time.
So let's go deeper into what you're talking about because you said a monthly. Well, shoot, they get a monthly Medi-Cal check,
right?
Exactly. Welfare check. They get a welfare check, but who does it come from? The government, who controls it?
Right.
So it's interesting you say that because when you talk about it going back into the stores, because here's the deal. I've talked to a lot of older people that I've noticed that have seemed to retire and they got pretty good income. And one of the things that we talk about was, let's think about this. When we were younger and we were going to a bank, mm-hmm. we always went to the teller, right? And we deposited our money to the teller. But the day you walk in the bank and people say, we want to come over and sit down, we can talk to you about some stuff. But no one talked to us about that because they was never leading us to the chair. They were leading us to the teller. So just like you said, we would get the money and we go spend it at the Nike place. We were just depositing our money into the bank. We weren't talking about, oh, what about that CD? What about that money market?
Is $240,000 enough?
$240,000 to who?
That's what they're talking about, giving us reparations.
That's California.
Per person, California.
That's California. That's not the national.
No, I'm talking, California is the only person that is really talking about doing it and implementing it.
They're talking about it all over the United States and
I'm hearing
a few
more,
places.
I'm hearing
but
more California
actually has
is on the forefront.
Yeah, they're on the forefront of it. And if California actually does it, it's going to open it up.
So they give you $240,000. What you going to do with it?
Oh, because I'm a businessman. I'm gonna be real with you. I know how to turn 240 into a million.
Right.
So if you give me 240, it ain't going on a new car. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, that's just real because most people, if you check out the average bank account, most people don't even have $600 in their bank account.
Right.
I'm talking about this is everybody.
Yeah, right. That's the American average.
American average. So $240,000, if you know how to use $240,000 and do what you're supposed to do, you get out of California, go to the South,
buy
a house cash.
Right.
Put some up, $100,000, see if you can find a money market account to get 6% interest off of it.
Look at him breaking it down.
Yeah, you can make it. You can make it.
But a lot of that money is going to get squandered. We know that. And I guess they're planning on it.
I would consider most of that money being squandered.
Right.
Because again, knowledge is power. And knowing where to go, what he just talked about, that's all knowledge. Knowledge on how he can make that 250 into a million. But if you know you're never doing that knowledge, see, we walk in the bank, went straight to the teller. We go sit down with the guy. A perfect example, you look at the movie Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yeah.
He put let's think about what he did. When he went to go in the banks, he was going to the banks, not because the banks were giving him money, because he knew where to place that money. Mm-hmm. And so when he went in the banks and they says, yeah, he came out with over $350 million, they were giving him money. He wasn't going to the teller. He was getting a check from the people sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. When we don't go in and know how to take that money use it. You know what I mean? And that's one of my things as a teacher. I'm talking to the young kids about how to save that money, where to put that money at. You just don't go to work if you stay at your home. I told the kid, if you work 25 hours a week, you stay at home, your parents might ask you to just pay the phone bill. And you got a car payment, and your parents fortunate enough to pay the car payment and insurance. They just ask you to pay the phone bill. You know, if you're making 20 hours a week, that's $1,800 a month. If you put $200 in an IRA, you still pocketing $1,500 a month. And you pay yourself and you save your money, but you still put it in an account. If you do that in an IRA, Roth IRA, from 18 to 26, at 26, you can stop paying on it.
But shouldn't that be a blueprint that should be shared?
They're not going to share it.
And they definitely don't want it taught.
That's what should be taught in school.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Economics class needs to be a real economics class.
Let's switch up real quick. Immigration. What's your thoughts on that? You said that stuff at El Paso, all those people out there just.
Oh, I was in El Paso.
Man.
I was in El Paso.
Trying to come into the country.
I'm going to tell you one of the things that, you know, I was there in spring break. The country, yeah. One of the things that really caught me, that really, coming from the airport, my brother-in-law picks me up. We go to dinner, and then we're going to my sister-in-law lives on the borderline of El Paso in New Mexico. She bought a brand new home there. It's pretty much, but she do all of her shopping in El Paso.
El Paso.
So yeah. I can look out her door mm-hmm. when I step out on the porch and look into El Paso.
See Juarez.
But what I can look off to the right and see Juarez. I yeah. see, I want to say the east side of Juarez. But when we were driving and my brother-in-law was saying, you see that dark part? He said, that's the border. But the freeway we pass, there's a freeway that goes in there, comes out. And I said, well, are they coming in and out every day? He said, yeah, people work from there, come over, they go back over. Mm-hmm. And then there's a stretch of highway that says 54. Well, that 54 rides into the second biggest army base in the United States, Fort Bliss. Mm. And they named it, and it's interesting because they call it 54, but what people don't know is that was the Mexican-American War. Mm. From the Mexican-American War, when that war was won by the United States, they took over Arizona, New Mexico, California, Utah from that war.
Texas, too?
Texas, too,
yeah.
All that was taken from that Mexican-American War. But then when you look over, and I look, there's 2 million people right there. When I look over, and it's like, it's a border, it's 2 million people, El Paso, Texas, New Mexico. And it looked weird to me.
Yeah.
Like it did, it looked worse than San Diego going over.
Yeah.
It was crazy, 2 million people.
I remember we driving going to Texas, going to see my son, surprise him actually, because he was in southern Texas, driving down the 10 through El Paso and looking to the left, and this flourishing city of El Paso,
yes.
And looking to the right and seeing Juarez and seeing the contrast. Man, there was a big contrast between the rich on the American side and the poor on the Mexican side. I was like, wow.
It looked
shanty towns.
Yes. It looked like,
bro, I was devastated. Just like, wow. Look at this. This is crazy.
And so you asked a question about immigration. When I look over there and I look back and I see all these people flourishing and doing well, because it came out that El Paso, Texas was like one of the safest places in America.
Wow.
It was one of the safest places. I'm looking, and there's a flood of people. When I look over there and I saw those houses, you talk about immigration, I'm going, man, these are people just trying to make it.
Yeah, trying to make it.
They're trying to, like, bring in their kids, and then their kids get separated. And then, okay, then they don't tell the truth. Some of those kids, they flooded into a foster care system.
Yes.
We had a kid that came all the way from Juarez that ended up at our school. So he's been filtered through foster care, from foster care, and do not know where his family is at.
Wow.
And so though you feel and empathize for people wanting to make their life better, they're right across it. I saw those. It looked like they were on top of each other.
On top of each other.
And I'm looking over here, and I'm like, man, people are driving freely, nice cars, you know. And
I could see how the people on the other side of that fence want. They want that. They want what they see. They want that American dream, man. Or a fraction of it. Or a piece of it.
And I think the hardest part for me is this. If we think about this. In California, like, for people to cross the border and to be working all the way in Nebraska, and you knew that the money they make, they were sending back over there.
Uh-huh.
You took, it's like slavery, you took their labor to make yourself rich, but you never really cared about the people you had working for you, because they were making pennies on a dollar and they sending it back. So many people working in governor's homes and people's homes, cutting their lawn.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of a sudden we have an immigration problem. And so now we want to send people back, build up a wall, but we let them over in the first place to do the work that we didn't want to do.
We don't want to do it, right.
And that's what I don't know. That gets me, like, and people are like, so quick to talk about it and how down it is. Don't let them over the border. So what? Send them back. But wait a minute. You brought them over. You allowed them to live in your houses. I know people who have them living in their houses and they're still illegal. You didn't help them get their citizenship.
Should have.
And you should have, because they were working for you.
Yep.
But you want to send them back. And I've seen it over and over. They're in rich people's homes. And not one of them have tried to get them their citizenship that I know of.
Right.
And then they want no different than what we want.
How do you feel about that, Santana?
I don't know who's going to mow your lawn and blow them leaves and pick your strawberries for you if you ship them all back. Oh. Guess it's just going to sit there and pile up.
Well, it's exploitation at its finest.
Say
exploitation
the least.
At its finest. If it's if it benefits certain people, then they're gonna take as much as they can until they have to pay the piper.
Hispanic people are not the only ones that send money back home. Asian people do that too. They work out here and they send money back home. That's just the way it is.
It's interesting.
It is interesting.
I'm going to say what's interesting about it is, where do black people send money back to?
Mm.
You don't know where to send it to. Hello. Who are you going to send it to?
Light just went on in the head.
Mm-hmm. We don't send it to nobody.
It's just interesting when I heard that, because I'm like, man, that's true.
But we do give it back because we're buying cars and jewelry.
But we're not giving it back to us.
We're not giving it back to us. Why is that we cannot build an infrastructure that can sustain us? Willie, why, Willie?
Because you have to be able to control something. And if you're not in a control position, there's a problem. Mm. Anything we ever built up, they burned down. If you think about all the cities and some of, I know there's at least 13 lakes that are over, that was over thriving black communities in the past in the United States. So when you think about that, you think about all the money that could have been generated by all of that in totality. Then look at this. If they had those communities, then black people would have seen examples of better. Getting rich instead of poverty all the time. You can go back and look at some of the older pictures just on the internet. Man, we used to dress to the nine.
Right.
Every
right.
day.
Every day.
Every day. So why are they dressing to the nine if they broke, poor? They dressing to the nine every day. So and they had smiles on their faces.
Mm-hmm.
Until somebody came in our communities and burned them down, blew them up. Took the land.
Yep.
Allowed the substances to come in, because they didn't come in. We might have started learning how to make it, but we didn't bring it in. It was brought in first. Mm-hmm. And then it was, how do we tone it down to make it? We don't have to go to them. We can figure it out ourselves. But it was brought in. And how does it just come in directly into certain communities? Although we know it's now widespread, because eventually all evil going to go where it needs to go anyway. But at the same time, what it has done, what I see, is I see, except for the student, you know, we sit at the table and we're fortunate and blessed to be able to sit here and talk about this and have been able to do certain things. But what I see is a lot of directionless kids. A lot of them. They're not getting it from home. They don't gravitate to it. When you talk about it, like, it goes over their head. But then the ones that I do see, and that's far in between, you can see it. You can see the impact that it makes. And so, like Willie was saying, if you never saw a doctor, if you never saw this, what kind of impact is it going to be? You know, it's so bad that they can't even look at me as a coach, me as a teacher, and want to gravitate to that and try to make a difference. It doesn't, because they've never seen enough examples of it. And that's why I say in schools, there's not enough people at the table. There's not enough people as assistant superintendent.
Black folks you're talking about.
Yes.
Right? African-Americans.
And even Hispanics, they're not at the table. They can't make decisions for each other. So you don't know you can't empathize with what's going on when you're not at the table.
That's true.
And so it's very difficult. So here we can, when you asked that question earlier about what can we do, what you can do, what I can do, what Willie can do, what Santana can do is, with what we do know, we can start a process. I can leave something for my kids. I can leave something back. I can have a will and trust that if I leave, they have something mm-hmm. to build on, to take care of, and then they can do something. I can give them the wisdom while I'm still alive about how they can get things done. Not just for my family, but for other people's family. Because if I don't spread the knowledge, they ain't gonna know. Mm-hmm. So that's what I can do.
So, as we're talking, these questions come up in my mind. We have transformed from one word to another. What do you guys want to be called? You want to be called Black? You want to be called Negro? You want to be called African American? Is there a preference? Even with the Latinos, Mexican, Chicana, Latin American or whatever, Afro-Latino. How did all this stuff? I mean, is our branding? I guess an evolution. I mean, we went from Negro to Black to African American, colored. I mean, I think about all that stuff, man. It's like, why can't we just be
American
or be us? Whatever.
I will say this. If you check the laws and you check the Constitution and you do some research in those areas, you will find that you do need to be called something to get something. If you go out there and call yourself all these different things, you may not be under the Constitution.
There's boxes now.
Watch this, though. I'll tell you funny.
On applications.
If you watch this, these people that are calling themselves nationalists now, Moors.
Moors.
Moors. Wow. Moors. Negroes and Hebrews are all pretty much the same.
Yeah.
And now they're getting their paperwork where they don't have to have a driver's license. They don't have to pay taxes. They go to court and they know how to speak as the straw man for their person. Hmm. That's a whole nother discussion.
Another discussion.
But if you don't know who you are, then you don't know how to get what's supposed to come to you.
Right.
And that's what they don't want, is just us to have the knowledge of who we truly are, so that they can keep on with the game, that they can keep on, and the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Mm. So what are you, Jeff? If they're going to put a label on you, what are you?
I always think about that too. And I think for me, I still think about it. I'm trying to feel like, as you say, I sit back and I kind of think about, what does it really mean?
But like you said, it has to mean something. Because it has importance. It has importance on applications, on loans. It has importance. So I'm black.
I've always put black.
I ain't gonna be nothing else but black. Call me black.
My first house, me and my wife went to buy, because she is Mexican.
A Latina.
Latina. When they try, they came back, they had white on my application because it says my last name.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I was like, no, change that to black.
To black.
Because I've earned the right to buy this house. I've qualified to buy this house. So put black on my paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd rather stay with black for me than African American. And the reason why I say that is because, as Willie said, where do our money go? Does it go to any African nation? No, it don't go to any African nation. So why went on and called myself African? And there has been a lot of Africans that do think that black Americans are really not African.
Mm-hmm.
And we know why, and whatever understanding they have. So for me, I'd rather be called black.
What about you, Will?
I'd rather be called, real talk, I'd rather be called a Hebrew Israelite or a Hebrew or something like that. But see, that's a whole nother ball game, because we've never really studied it here. We don't truly know who we truly are, because we came so many different ways. Many people came different. And a lot of people don't realize there was a lot of quote, quote, blacks already here.
Right.
They were
before
here,
slavery,
way before slavery.
Uh-huh.
And so they was here. And so when we get to the history, if somebody wanted to really open up the vaults to figure out who we are, man, many of us was Indians.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot
many
of mixture.
Many of us were supposed to be getting reparations on that part.
Mm. We didn't get none of that.
We didn't get none of that. And I had Indian in my family,
mm.
for sure, in Louisiana. Yep. You see my grandmother, you would think my mom, my dad's mom, you'd think she's Indian.
Yeah, that's where all my roots are, in Shreveport.
Yeah.
And Caddo Parish.
And if you had saw my great-great-grandfather, which I saw in 1969, he looked just like an Indian chief.
Mm.
Yes.
Just like one. I mean, the features and everything, because I remember seeing him. I asked my mom, is that my great-grandfather, he Indian? Because he looked like it to me. You know what I mean? And so it's funny that you mentioned that, because people didn't know that there had been Portuguese and Spanish sailors that had sailed in America well before it was formed. And there was a lot of free blacks that was on the boat exploring all those nations that we talked about, that where most of the African slaves were given, the Caribbean. There were actual Africans on those boats, not as slaves. They were explorers. Getting off the boat with those sailors as free men.
As free Negroes.
As free. And they don't know that they came down into Mexico and dropped off slaves that was there as slaves with Spaniards and Aztec Indians that were already here before Christopher Columbus. So.
Santana. What you want to be called?
That's so interesting. I don't care for being called Caucasian on my birth certificate. I don't like when they come, the census people come and, oh, okay, so you're Caucasian, but you're Hispanic. I've never understood that. You know, my parents are listed as Caucasian on my birth certificate, on their birth certificates. And it just doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm not Caucasian. I'm Latina, Chicana. I prefer something like that than...
Here's my question, and maybe you might know this. And when, because when I came to California, Mexican people were Mexican. And then I heard Chicano. Those are the only two words I ever heard come to California. When did all of a sudden, when did all of a sudden we became Latino and Hispanic? Is where, who
made up those names?
Yeah, like who gave that?
It wasn't Mexican people.
Mm. Hispanic is not a Mexican.
No. I'm trying to remember who came up with that, but that's not something my people came up with.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's kind of, I want to say it's a Spanish thing. It's a Spanish thing.
Because I've heard Mexican people don't want to be called or lapped with Puerto Rican. I've heard Guatemalans and all that don't want to be lumped with being Mexican. So how they lump you all in the Latino, Hispanic, I like, who did that? Like, I never knew that Hispanic to me has really came up in the last 12 years out there.
Yeah.
I know Mexican people to be Mexican people.
And I heard they didn't like the Hispanic because of the term, because of the panic in it. They didn't want
the panic in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of considered like derogatory to some people. Yeah. And you're right. Guatemalans, El Salvadorians, they don't.
Dominicans.
You need to be yours. Don't call me Mexican.
Mm.
They get it's a real sensitive subject.
And I've heard that. So that's why I've always wondered why they clumping everybody under the Hispanic umbrella.
Because it was easier to do that. They came up with the name. You know, there was a whole lot of other names. And like I was telling you guys earlier, like, I don't really know all these tribes that were in. What this all was Mexico at one time. So there was a lot of tribes with different names. I can't even pronounce the names. Okay. But I think that's why a lot of them call themselves Chicano. You know, there's a...
But isn't that more street? Like a, that's more of a street term, more of a hood thing, right?
I'm
a Chicana.
Yes, but it's because of this Hispanic thing.
And I see that there seems to be a movement towards going back to Chicana and Chicano. I'm hearing this now because they want to like separate because they feel like they're being grouped with people they don't want to be grouped with because Guatemalans are different. They're different than Mexico, even though they be coming through. They be coming through. And I've heard a lot of different people, a lot of men say they treat them pretty bad too.
Check this out though. This is okay. So this is a weird thing too. So my mother's side of the family, they're all from New Mexico, Nuevo Mexico. Okay. So the food, just the food, all by itself is different than if you went into Mexico.
Right. Is it Tex-Mex?
No.
It's just different. It's just different. And I know that because my grandmother, you know, her cooking, I grew up on that cooking and I know the difference. So, you know, I try to find places out here that have that, but it's just, I have to go to Albuquerque to go eat. To get that authentic New Mexico taste that I am familiar with.
Because you're a Latina. You're a Latina,
I'm
right?
A Latina.
You're a Latina. All right, well, appreciate y'all input. Thanks, Willie, for showing up again. Hope to have you back again. We'll probably think of another topic that'd be intriguing for the mind, body, and soul of this podcast. I want to thank everybody for listening to our podcast. We really appreciate your thoughts and feedback. We leave this email address so people can provide input, comments, questions. We're always looking to improve. We're always looking to uplift. You can reach us at walkingwithpurposepodcast@gmail.com. Will, you want to give out your information again? Where people can reach you if they need to?
Big Will Style 1@yahoo.com.
And tell them some of the stuff that you, the products that you have for sale.
Well, we do. Well, what I'm mostly do is custom framing and custom dominoes, chess boards.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you make chess pieces too?
I make chess boards also.
Wow.
Yes. So that's what we mostly do. Oh, right now I'm doing some for a Black Fatherhood group.
Mm.
I'm doing some for the Tuskegee Airmen group.
Wow.
So, yeah, we do.
Yeah, I'm going to have to come check out your stuff, man.
Yeah, we do a lot. And then if you want to smell good, I got the good smelling oils.
Yeah. You tell us a little bit about those oils, too.
Oh, my God. I know. I can tell you.
I'm wearing a signature scent today.
A Latina word.
Hey. She might be trying to get a Negro.
I might.
Trying to get a Negro.
Negro Latina.
Tell us a little bit about those oils. Because I've heard a lot about
them. Yeah,
a lot
the of oils is, the good thing about them is they're pure and they last a lot longer than cologne or perfume. So you put it on in the morning, especially on nice days where it's nice and hot. You'll smell it in the morning, but it'll be coming out even more in the evening.
Mm.
You might not be smelling it, but everybody
around you would be.
Be smelling it because it'll be used to you by that time.
Okay. Is there different fragrances?
Oh, I have hundreds of fragrances.
Wow. I should have told you to bring some so we could smell it.
As a matter of fact, what's funny is I got a guy meet me at the house about 12:30 today to pick up some oil before he go on vacation.
All right. Here's the lovely Santana with today's words of wisdom.
Your life will change when you realize the power of choice. What you choose to commit your time and energy to matters. The thoughts you choose to dwell on matters. The people you choose to be in a relationship matters. Be mindful of your choices. If you won't stand.